that we are distracted. We're walking down the road, we smell a rose, we think of a rose that happened when we gave it to our mother, and then and we have these stories that just go on, and we start off here and we end up over there. Or we're listening to someone's conversation to us and we go, oh yeah, and I remember, and all of a sudden we're off in our own conversation, we're nodding to this person, but we're actually formulating our own information. We very rarely listen consciously. And what the beauty about meditation is, it's not a result in itself, it's a training. The result of meditation is mindfulness, knowing what our minds are doing at any one moment. And so the practice of mindfulness is, in a sense, enhances our practice of meditation, and meditation enhances mindfulness. Mindfulness is the new buzzword in business these days. Being present. Being absolutely present. And it's particularly in business, if a lot of you go into business when you finish your studies, one of the things I teach in business courses is the mindfulness of communication, where you actually, and you can do this as a practice, this is a homework I give business people, is in the next week, listen to someone with 100% attention without running your own story. Just try it once. So have one conversation, you'll be talking to someone, and I hope you remember it, and just be totally present to that conversation. It's an interesting experience for them, but it's an extraordinary experience for you because you actually listen. And I was doing a government department, teaching a meditation and mindful course for a government department a year or so ago, and I talked about this practice of being mindful in communication, actually taking the present communication as all there is. And this woman came back to me the next week and she said, that's the first time I have ever listened to my teenage son. She said we had the most unbelievable afternoon. He was telling me a story, and instead of me going, oh, don't be silly, or trying to give him advice or trying to change his story, she said, I just sat and listened. And she said he completely opened up and I opened up. She said it was a completely different experience. Thank you very much. I said, don't thank me, you did it. And that's just one process that meditation does. It develops this ability to be present now. Because we don't actually have a future. If we have the future, I'd like someone to show it to me. Where is it? Now I want someone to show me their past. Impossible. Past's in there. There is no past. There's a memory of past events, but there is actually no past. And all we really have is an ever-moving forward present. And the extraordinary thing about Buddhism, that started with the Buddha 2,500 years ago, he worked this out. And I remember one Tibetan Lama said, well, the difference between us and a Buddha is the Buddhas aren't distracted. That's it. They have no distraction. And if you think about during meditation when you said, oh, I've brought my back a million times, it's according to Buddhist thought, you have 65 mind moments to a finger snap. That's how fast the mind moves. So we're constantly doing this scanning. And one of the most incredible people that I've had the pleasure of meeting was the Dalai Lama. And the Dalai Lama has the most unbelievable present attention that you can ever experience. Quite unnerving, actually. When you talk to him, he is totally there. There's no one else in the entire universe. And you feel extraordinarily exposed. And I saw it happen. It was a very interesting situation. I was running security at one point for the Dalai Lama when he was in Sydney. And I was at a business meeting downstairs with all these business heads and the Dalai Lama. And there were reporters. And there's a television reporter called Kerry O'Brien who is extremely skilled in talking to politicians and heads of government and very, very, very well controlled. not fazed by anything, asks the tough questions. And the Dalai Lama was sort of sitting to the side, and Kerry O'Brien was there, and I was standing over there just watching, and Kerry O'Brien puts his hand up and says, "Oh, Your Holiness, I'd like to ask you a question." Then Dalai Lama just turns around and says, "Yes." And this poor, skilled, well-intentioned reporter completely fell apart. From just one piece of attention, he started stumbling, he started mumbling, he blushed, he went, never would he have done that on television to any politician. And I just thought, and the Dalai Lama wasn't doing it unkindly, it was just the power of this present concentration. The good news about that from Buddhism is that we all have the ability to develop that. We all have the ability to be present. All it needs is training. And so what the Buddha really taught was all these extraordinary methods to overcome our 84,000 delusions. But what he first taught when he got on the planet, when he first became enlightened, was he taught what? For older students. Well, don't yell at me all at once. What was the first teaching of the Buddha? Come on. Four noble truths. Yeah, don't be bashful. It's okay. Nothing happens if you get it wrong, but it's good if you get it right. So the Four Noble Truths. This was the when the Buddha became enlightened, he was confused as to... I'm going to take this watch off, I'm going to bash it. He was confused... Well, not confused. He was wondering what he would teach. All of a sudden, his mind had opened to the entire cosmos, in a sense. What do you teach people whose minds aren't open? What's your option? You teach them about their condition that they understand. And the first condition was what? Suffering. Suffering or dissatisfaction. He was able to say to people, do you have dissatisfaction? Do you not get what you want? Do you, when you've got what you want, does it sometimes get taken away? Yeah, we get that. Well, this is the nature of samsara, of what we're living in. And the more we try and grab the things that are impermanent, the more suffering we have. So there is suffering, there is dissatisfaction. And then he said, there is a cause to this dissatisfaction, the second noble truth. There's a reason that we have this dissatisfaction. What's that?
Greed.
Delusion. Yeah. Firstly, delusion. Out of delusion comes attachment and aversion, or greed and anger. But firstly, there's delusion, and it's the delusion that we don't know how things operate. We see it all the time. People think that if they just get a little more money, then they'll be happy. There was a story many years ago of a guy called John Paul Getty Jr. And at one point, he was the richest man in the world. He was an oil baron in America. And he had billions and billions of dollars. And so money was really no object. He could afford anything. Except in his house, he had a payphone where people would have to put some money in the phone if they wanted to make a call from his house. And there he was, a billionaire. And they asked him towards the end of his life, how much money did he want? And he said, just a little more. And so there was this guy with billions of dollars, was not even satisfied with that. He just wanted more. And this greed comes out of the ignorance of not knowing how things operate, not knowing how the world operates. And so the Buddha was able to say, okay, so firstly, there is suffering, there's a cause of suffering. Not knowing how it works causes you to make mistakes and create the suffering. The third noble truth is there is a path out of suffering. There's a way to get out of this. And the Buddha said, I cracked it. I got this one. I understand it. I'm going to tell you how to do it. There's a path out of this suffering. And the good news, there is an end to this suffering. Once you have trod the path in a particular way. And every, and interesting, I'll say this, we talk about the Buddhist path, but every single person has their own Buddhist path. Every single person has their way of doing it. Some are more effective than others, but we all have our own way of doing it. At my Buddhist centre, there's 30 or 40 people that come along, and every single person, although they're listening to the same teachings, has their own take on it. Sure, there's limits to it, but there is the way that they perceive it and the way that they interact with the world. So in a sense, this is why I said in the beginning, it's about self-responsibility. It's about the way that you take the information and apply it to your life and find out how it works. So Buddhism is, yes, it's theoretical, but it's useless being theoretical. It has to actualize our lives. And if Buddhism is effective, then we notice the way that we react to things. We deal with things in a different way. When things become impermanent in our lives, we don't totally freak out, because we know from the Buddhist teachings that all things are impermanent. Everything that's created, everything that we create becomes impermanent. So why are we going to get so upset? When our new Mercedes-Benz gets its first scratch, cars get scratched. Has anyone had a new car here? Has anyone been traumatised when they got the first scratch? Yeah. That's what happens. I've had a new one for about 12 months, and about 5 or 6 months ago someone ran a key along the side of it, and I just left it there, and people go, "Oh no, your car," and I go, "Yeah, that's what happens. You've nice new case, someone's going to run a key along it." The car goes fine. Probably when it's got enough dents or someone runs into the side of it, I'll get it panel beaters and it'll be all new again. But the point being is, there's no point fretting over things that we have no control of, which is impermanence. And these were some of the lessons that the Buddha was able to teach. Now I'm going to move more into it, but first I'm going to say a little bit about the tradition of Buddhism for those that are new to it. So 2,500 years ago, about 563 BCE, the Buddha was born near Nepal. He taught for over 50 years. And what he was teaching is the techniques to overcome suffering, techniques to overcome dissatisfaction. It says in the different traditions that in Myanmar, the oral tradition speaks that the Buddha visited there four times, in Burma, Myanmar, and also Sri Lanka. Buddhism came to Thailand about 218 years after the death of the Buddha. In 70 AD into China, the spread of Buddhism came to Korea around about 200 to 300 AD. Tibet around 600 AD, and Japan around the 8th century. So it spread slowly through the world, and it's only really come to the West, you know, in modern times. As I said, the Four Noble Truths was the basic teaching of the Buddha, and then it expanded from there. The three poisons that it's often talked about in Buddhism, as I've described, is ignorance, desire and hatred. Having this aversion, pushing away all the things we don't want and grasping towards all the things we want, keep us in this constant state of agitation. And from an agitated mind comes all the things we don't need in our lives. From an agitated mind comes anger, hatred, frustration, depression, and, from a business point of view, bad business decisions, bad communication, and overall lack of wisdom. And from a calm mind develops all the qualities that we need in life: compassion, love, understanding, wisdom, not a lack of wisdom, but the development of wisdom, and above all, this universal sense of peace interacting with other human beings. And the more we train in that, the more that becomes part of our nature. If we train in anger, if everything that we see frustrates it, or everything that isn't to our liking creates anger in our lives and frustration, we become experts in anger and frustration. And I'll tell you a funny story. In about the early 80s, there was a movement across the world, a New Age movement, that said, get rid of your anger. Once you've got rid of your anger, you're free of it. So there were clinics, some in Australia, where people would go along and they were given a tennis racket and a pillow, and they would scream out all the things that they disliked. And they would, has anyone heard of this movement? And they would whack these pillows, yelling at them and bashing away. And afterwards they'd be exhausted and they felt a whole lot better. Then they'd come back next week and they'd have a whole lot more to bash around. And I was telling this story at the Buddha Center one time, and this woman said, oh yeah, I went to one of those. She said the guy that was running it, he was the angriest guy I've ever met. If you train in that, then that's what happens. And Buddhism doesn't buy into that. You don't train in negative behaviour. Yes, you don't suppress it either. You don't say, oh, no, not angry, not angry, not angry, bang. You actually recognise it, but then you take time with yourself to realise that that state of anger is not beneficial. It doesn't give you good judgment. It doesn't create good relationships. And the secret between purifying, well, in a sense, acting out anger, experiencing anger and then acting it out, what happens? What's the interface? What is the antidote, actually, to anger? Patience. Just patience. When we recognise that frustration coming up, and then just taking time with ourselves going, ah, this is anger, this is frustration, and taking time to sit with it. And I'll give you an example, and some of you have been here for a while and will remember this example, a lot of you won't. As many years ago, I was driving in my car across the expressway on the way to Bondi, the Sid Iron-filled expressway. This is a great experience. These little things happen if you ever act consciously, which occasionally I do. And I was driving in the car, and I was on the inside lane, and this guy in the other lane started to cross in front of me without looking. And we were both doing about 80, so it was going to be a bit of a crash. And I beat my horn, and he went, whoop. And I didn't do anything more with it. I didn't drive up beside him and shake my fist, you idiot. Or to look what he looked like, whether he was wearing a hat. He was very old, I'd forgive him, but if he was a young person, shake my fist. I didn't do that. I just thought, and I went through the contemplation of that. I thought, well, I know for a fact this guy didn't do it on purpose. This guy, I don't know for a fact, but I was pretty sure this guy didn't want to end his life that Tuesday afternoon. You know, if I had sat down with him, did you want to die that Tuesday afternoon in a horrible car crash? He would have said, no, I don't actually. So I was pretty sure on that. And then I thought to myself, he made a mistake. And then I thought to myself, have I ever made a mistake? Sure have. I'm very careful, by the way, of looking behind. But sometimes inattention. And I thought, okay, well, no problem. Finished. I thought, oh, that was okay. And then I forgot about it, and I drove down the hill, and we came to a set of lights, and it just so happened that I pulled up beside him, and he turned around and went, thanks. And I just got such a shock. Here was a guy thanking me for preventing an accident between us. Not, why did you blow your horn? And there was this just fabulous communication. Just happened from me warning someone they were going to have a prank and me not getting upset about it. So there was a communication between us. And to this day, I am telling you now, I am more careful about my blind side than I probably ever was in driving before that. And probably he is too, because it cemented in my mind the action of non-violence and anger. I didn't have to get angry with the guy. We in Australia, in Asian countries, as you know, people blow horns to warn each other. In Australia, we blow horns to yell at people, don't we? You notice that? A horn's there for protection, not to use your frustration. And if we do that, if we use those horns, then they become far more meaningful. If we prevent accidents just by being conscious. So that's just one little example of the difference between anger and patience, and how patience diffuses that anger. And so we have ignorance, desire and hatred. Desire, as I said earlier, this constant wanting. If only that person was in my life, then I'd be happy. If only that person was out of my life, then I'd be happy. If only I had a little more money, if only, and then I'll be happy, and then I'll be happy. And when we do that in our lives, which I must say advertising on television and papers draws you to it, if you buy this, you are going to be happy. And we all go, oh, really? I'll buy two. And we keep getting drawn to this myth that acquiring more will make us happy. I remember there was a guy, a musician, who owned about 120 guitars. And they asked him how many guitars he wanted. And he said, well, you have all the guitars you need, plus you want one more. And he'd got to 120. Probably 125 by now. I don't know how many hands he had, but he could only play one at a time. And a friend of mine, many years ago, because I played guitar myself a little bit, and he went out and he bought himself a very, very expensive guitar. A lot of money. He desired it. He wanted it. He was going to buy it. He salivated over it. He read up on it. He went out and bought it. And he got this guitar, beautiful case, perfect. About 4 weeks later, might have been 2 months, I said, oh, how's your guitar? He said, I sold it. I said, what? He said it was torture. He said, here was this incredibly expensive guitar. He said, I couldn't take it to a party and play it because someone might trip on it and break it. He said, I kept it under the bed in case someone stole it. Every afternoon I came home to make sure it was there. I'd make sure the house was triple locked so my guitar didn't get stolen. He said it was a complete nightmare. He said I didn't want to play it too much in case there was a scratch. And he said, and this guy wasn't a Buddhist, but he got it. He said the thing of pleasure became an absolute source of pain by my attitude. So he sold it to another musician who couldn't care less. Same guitar, paid the same amount of money, didn't worry about it. Took it to parties, got scratched, didn't care. Had no attachment to the value in a sense. He didn't go out purposely and wreck it, but he just didn't have that attachment to this beautiful instrument. So what I'm saying there, it's not the object that's the problem. It's the attitude to the problem. And that's what Buddhism is about. It's about changing our minds. Changing the way we view things. It's very difficult in quite a lot of ways to change our circumstances for a lot of people. But we can change the way that we view it. And that's the important thing. There was a very famous Tibetan yogi called Milarepa. And Milarepa had some rags that he wore and one bowl that he cooked his nettle soup in. They reckon he drank, this is in Tibet, he drank so much nettle soup he started to go green. Do you drink nettle? No. And he had this clay bowl And he'd cook his nettle soup in it. And apparently that story goes, one day he came out of his cave and he tripped over it and broke his only possession. And they reckon they could hear him laughing from miles around going, impermanence, how fabulous. Instead of a source of suffering, he just saw the humour of the whole deal. You know, the only possession you've got and you trip over and break it. For us, for me, it would be, what am I going to cook my soup in? But for him, it was a source of amusement because he wasn't attached to it, because he didn't have this intense grasping. And it's the same for us with aversion. If we have aversion towards somebody, we go, oh, I can't stand that person. Every time they come near me, I feel agitated and angry and, you know, they're just a bad person. And then you ask that person's mother, I'm like, no, he's a wonderful boy. He's a wonderful girl. Fabulous. Hold it. Mother thinks the child's fabulous and this person thinks that they're awful. What are they? What are they? Who are they? How can two people have different views? Because we do this all the time. We form these strong views about people that are based actually on our own karma. I'll talk a little bit more about karma, but in a sense what happens is that we build up these impressions in our mind about many, many things as we grow up. From our culture, from our parents, from our own thinking, but predominantly from our own karma. And it's a bit like this. We form these views, it's like we have a projector there, we project them out, we look at them and go, oh, that's the way things are. That's it. That's the way things are. I know, because I saw it. But in fact, what we're doing is projecting quite often our own thoughts and emotions onto the situation and reading it from our own perspective. And we know that for a fact. If there was one tune, if you've ever listened to a tune that you really like and you go to your friend and say, listen to this piece of music or listen to this tune, isn't it fantastic? They go, no, I don't like it. You go, no, but can't you understand it's just beautiful? And they go, no, I don't like it. And you go, how can you not like it? And they go, well, I don't like it. And the point being is, it's a different point of view. The music is just the music. But the view of it comes from our attitude and the way we form things. And so Buddhism is about cutting through that. Absolutely cutting through that. One Tibetan Lama said, and he was talking about seeing emptiness directly or seeing the real nature of how phenomena existed. He said, if you want to really perceive the truth of everything, just accept that everything you think and everything you do is wrong. Which is a rather radical approach. But it kind of cracks the egg of our self-assuredness. Any questions? Come on, give me a question. Yes?
Okay, so, I've been, trying to, live with, the ideas of Buddhism to, not really care about anything, really, ever. And the main criticism that I get from, my own mother is that I'm, a very indifferent person, how, I just don't care, and, that's, a bad thing somehow.
Don't you care?
Not really. I don't really care about anything. I don't know, I'm just, carefree. But, that bothers her. It's a flaw.
Do you ever get upset?
Not really, no.
Well, then you're doing okay. Well, what? How can I add to that? If you feel calm, relaxed, life goes well for you, you don't get disappointed. Okay, fine.
But to her, that's a flaw. I want to be a good dog.
She thinks you're irresponsible, do you? Is she? Do you do well at your studies? Hey, Albert, there's a chink in the armour here.
I mean, to find out, how about the average?
So you do okay.
I guess that's good, yeah. To love people, that's good. To love people, that's bad. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think it's okay.
Yeah. Look, all of us have different ways of viewing things, and I think, yeah, at times, but I have to say, when you come up against real suffering, okay, so sometimes you can go reasonably well for a while, and then intense suffering hits you. Someone dies, you see something really awful, and then and I'm not saying it's not going to happen, it will happen to you, but what happens then, that's where you test your faith. when the wheels fall off the trolley. It's okay when things are going fine, we're all pretty okay with that. But when things don't go the way we want them to go or disaster happens, that's when you see the true metal of your spiritual practice. And so if things are going fabulously, that's great. If things get wobbly and they don't go so well, that's when you need to bring in the spiritual practice of Buddhism. And Buddhism is really about actually generating happiness. The interesting thing is, the basic desire of all human beings is to be happy. That's it. We want to be happy. We don't want suffering. We don't want discomfort. We don't want all the negative things that happen to us. We just want to be happy. That's fine. What you have to find out, and this is why Buddhism is there in a sense, is to what are the things that actually generate happiness. And I just, last night I was teaching at the Buddhist Centre and we were talking about karma and the things that, by understanding the law of cause and effect, you're able to direct your life. And what, just one of the things the Buddha taught was how, well actually I'll ask you that. Where does wealth come from? What would be the karma that generates wealth in your life? I'm not talking about gambling, but I'm saying what generates wealth, what would be the karma? Does anyone know? It's actually generosity. The karmic effect of you being generous means that you become wealthy. Maybe not in this life, but eventually. By generating this sense of abundance for others, it creates this karmic result of abundance for ourselves. And the Buddha knew this, and he taught this very clearly, and what he said in the end was, I have practiced these disciplines, these ways of thinking, and they have achieved enlightenment. Enlightenment, first liberation, then enlightenment beyond suffering. That was the final noble truth. There is actually an end to dissatisfaction. And I'll say to you, if you're not having dissatisfaction now, great. I rejoice. That's fantastic. But, you know, in the next 10 or 20 years, if you have to experience things that cause discomfort, then you will see how you handle that. And if you handle it well, fantastic again. You know? So it's not about saying, oh, no, you've got to follow this Buddhist path because of... It's not about that. The Buddha actually said... The Buddha said... Sorry. He didn't say, look, follow these teachings because of me. He said, take what is useful for your lives and use it. And this is pretty much right across the board with Buddhism. The Dalai Lama himself says, I never tell people to change their religions, but if Buddhism has something that will benefit you, then use it. I had got a call from a Catholic priest one time, and he rang up the Buddhist Centre and he said to me, listen, you guys have a real handle on meditation. He said, I reckon Buddhists do meditation probably better than anybody. Can I come to your Buddhist classes and study meditation? I went, yeah, sure. So along comes the priest and he sat in there for 3 weeks and he got the meditation. He went, that was great, thank you. There was no, oh, now you've got to sign up. Nah, you've got to be a Buddhist to do this. None of that. And that was, in a way, what attracted me to Buddhism. I was free to take these extraordinary technologies and apply them to my life. And gradually I found that the more I applied, worked. Just this whole idea of generosity, of honesty. There was actually someone that said to me a while ago how they had gone into a shop. This is a few years ago. They'd gone into a shop and they'd bought some articles and the person had given them one more in the bag than they asked for. And they said, I don't know what to do about it. And I said, well, take it back. And they went, oh no, I don't want to be embarrassed. It's been 2 weeks. I'd be embarrassed if I took it back. And I said, well, go in and just pay for it. And I went, oh no, I don't want to be embarrassed. I said, well, you're carrying this burden around. I think the article was like $5 or something. you're carrying this $5 around. It's taken 2 weeks. You're asking me for my advice. And the thing you're scared about is embarrassment, when in fact you actually know you want to give it back, but you don't know how to do it. I said, just do it. I don't know if they actually did do it. But there was this kind of convoluted thing. Maybe they thought the shopkeeper would think they're dishonest or whatever. So there was this kind of ego grasping around not just being honest. I walked 2 blocks back. I was at a post office and I was given 20 cents too much. And I was away for like 10 minutes and went, looked at the charge and went, oh no. So I went back with the 20 cents and I gave it to the person behind the counter. And I said, you gave me 20 cents too much. And they went, are you kidding? Nobody ever does that. And I said, yeah, but I don't want the problem. I'm happy to walk back and make it square. I don't want the problem. I don't want to think about, I should have given that 20 cents back. To me, that was the practice of Buddhism. Just making it easy and simple. I was asked to lie once. I was massaging this very wealthy lady doing my shiatsu business. And some of you know this story. And it was my first time massaging this woman. And doing the massage. And the phone rings. And she says, quick, pick them up and tell them I'm not here. She's not here. I'm a husband. What are you doing here? I'm the burglar. I mean, what am I going to do? All of a sudden, from that one lie, I was going to start creating this whole monster. I could see it. There was this monster going to rear out of its... What are you doing in my house? Nothing. Where's my wife? Or whoever. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. She said, why not? It's only a little white lie. I went, no, I'm not going to do that. The phone's still ringing. I said, I can ring, pick up the phone and say, look, she's busy at the moment. She'll ring you back. I'll take a message. Or we cannot pick up the phone. She went, there you go. Let's not pick up the phone. But you see what happens? Just that minor lie could have created a whole drama in my life. May not have, but it could have. And who would have been at fault? Her or me? Me. Because I made the choice. And at every interface of our lives, we have a choice. Karma arrives. Opportunity arrives. We interface with our past moment by moment in the sense of karmic causes and conditions. Every moment we sit here is due to a previous cause that's created it. All of you sitting here tonight have had causes and conditions that have brought you here tonight. But at this point, we have a choice. And there was a wonderful line from one Lama who said, if you want a nasty person to go away and not return in your life, be nice to them. You've just created the karmic cause for that person to turn up in your life at a future time or a future life as a good person rather than a bad person. If you create the karmic cause of anger with that person, then the next thing that happens is they will turn up again and again. I know what question you're going to ask, but go for it. Yeah. Oh, did you have a question? Yeah, but go on. What about someone that is persecuting you? Is that what you're going to ask that question?
Oh, no.
Okay. I was wrong. Go on.
I just wanted you to, because you keep bringing up karma, I just wanted you to, like, clarify...
What karma is?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like, how that relates to
Cool.
Your perception of someone.
Okay. Yeah, good. Okay. Well, look, firstly, karma means cause and effect. We create a cause through our body, speech or mind. The most gross causes are bodily actions, right? And we can have negative causes and positive causes and some neutral, what they call neutral causes. Sitting down drinking a cup of tea is a reasonably neutral cause. Negative causes are, in a sense, harming others. That's pretty much it. Those negative causes will always, unless they're purified, and that's another subject, but we'll just do it simply. Those negative causes will always have a negative result. According to the Buddha, you cannot get a positive result out of a negative cause. So if I steal from someone in the future, I've created the cause to be stolen from. A positive cause will always result in a positive effect. So if I'm generous to someone in the future, generosity will happen. And this, the Buddha said this was a universal law, cause and effect. If we follow that action, those ideas and that thought, we also have to look at what the mind creates. And if we have negative attitudes towards people all the time, you will find that your whole life around you looks negative. Have you ever experienced when your mind is maybe a bit down or depressed? It can be the most beautiful sunshiny day, flowers are blooming, and everything looks grey. That's the interface of previous causes and conditions on a mental level. And if we start to know this, we then can, in a sense, manipulate those circumstances and turn those negative results into a positive effect. I had one yesterday. I stepped off a curb and a woman was backing up. And I just bounced off the back of a car. She wasn't going very fast. I bounced off it and stepped around it. And she opened a window and I said, "Oh, look, I'm really sorry, I wasn't watching." And she said, "No, I'm really sorry, I wasn't watching." There was an interface. I recognised I'd just made a friend. I could have made an enemy, and so could have she. But we both apologised and said, "No, it's both our faults." And it was both our faults. I wasn't looking and she wasn't looking. I was maybe in a blind spot. That's the interface I'm talking about. I had a choice at that moment to walk up to her window and yell at her and scream at her and say, "Why did you do that? You nearly ran me over. Blah, 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 blah." But I took the responsibility of walking across that road on myself. And so that was the interface that was, hopefully in the future, she will turn up as a friend and maybe not run me down again. But do you see what I'm getting at? Does that answer the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. So we have to be aware that every moment we are living, we have a choice right now. We can either go towards the dark side or we can go towards the light side. We can either make a choice for a positive view or we can make a choice for a positive or a negative view or a negative action. And this is where mindfulness comes in. And if we keep working on that, and it's the practice of meditation which allows us to see how the mind works. There's no other practice on this planet that looks directly at the mind like meditation. Now, I teach Tai Chi, and I say to people, it's like a moving meditation, but there's movement involved. Sure, there's a mind-body connection. But meditation, you're not even using the body, you're just looking at the mind directly. And you start to understand how your mind functions. But in another way, it also gives you a panoramic view of, it's hard to say, the energy of the mind. And you start to unhook from all the galloping forward. And when you do that, developing some kind of patience allows you to have a very clear view of how to deal with things. And so when you apply meditation every day, it calms the system down. It develops your intuition. It develops your wisdom. It develops your patience. And just by doing that practice, I've had people come to me after 3 or 4 weeks of meditation and come back and go, "This is actually changing my life. I'm viewing the way that I function in this world differently." And it works on depression, it works on agitation. Probably, I would say, the only people that you would not teach meditation to are people that have schizophrenia. Because in a sense, when you're meditating, you're disassociating yourself from all the different archetypes that you have in your life. The student, all the different ones that I mentioned. So I would caution people who had schizophrenia to be careful with meditation because it might make them a bit wobbly. But apart from that, everyone else benefits from meditation. And in the 20, 30 years that I've been teaching meditation, I've never had a failure. Every single person can bring their mind back to the point of attention at least once. And if you can do it once, you can do it again and again. And then gradually, it gets easier. Your mind becomes more peaceful and more stable. And out of that, you start to develop the quality of mindfulness. And out of the quality of mindfulness, you start to act responsibly. If the Buddha could have made us enlightened and remove our suffering, he would have done it. He has extraordinary compassion for all beings. Why hasn't he done it? Because he couldn't. Because it's up to us to dig ourselves out of the mess. Yeah?
I just want to ask, what is attention? Like, whenever I'm meditating, for example, I'm focusing on my nose, but this suddenly, turns into flowers, and then I started focusing on these little dots, and then it turns into other things.
So other things come in.
Yeah, so what is attention? So what should we...
What do you do when that happens, when other things come in?
What should we focus on?
Okay. Various things that you can focus on with single point of concentration is the sense of the breath going in and out of the nose. Okay? That's just one. In the Tibetan system, they do visualizations. Okay? So they visualize the Buddha. It's a mental picture. It's not a visual, not an eye picture. It's a mental picture. And so you would look at the Buddha, and then you would imagine in your mind's eye, that Buddha sitting there. And you can focus on that. So whatever... In fact, it's been said you could focus on a Mars bar. It kind of doesn't matter in the long run. It's better to focus on a holy object, by the way. You'll start going out... If you meditate on chocolate, you'll start going out and buying lots of chocolate and eating it afterwards. So it's not such a good idea. But whatever you hold your mind on, and the mind will do this. It'll think of something, something will come in, something will... You just leave it where it is. What often happens is people try to push it away or engage it. Leave it where it is and bring it back and bring it back. You've got to be compassionate with your meditation too. And for those that are beginning meditation, start off with only a few minutes a day. You have to nurture it. If you think meditation's good at the beginning and you decide to sit down for 2 hours, you will go, oh, I can't stand this. This is just awful. My legs hurt. My brain's going numb. I don't want to do it. So you start off with a very small amount of time and you just grow it, just gradually, like a plant. And then comfortably you'll be able to sit for half an hour and longer if you feel like it. I had a young gentleman come to me. He was 14 years of age. His father brought him to me. It's an interesting story. His mother had a master's of psychology, very smart mother. Mother and father had separated. And mother had said that this 14-year-old had ADD, attention deficit disorder. And the father said, I don't think my son has it. I want him to come and see you. So I sat down with this 14-year-old. He was sitting there like this, not very impressed with me at all. And as 14-year-olds aren't with older people. And I said, so... Don't like school, do you? He went, nah, can't stand it. I said, you get in a lot of trouble. He went, yeah, all the time. I said, well, you're an idiot, aren't you? And he went, what? I said, well, who's getting into trouble? He said, I am. Do you like it? No. Well, stop it. It was kind of funny. In the end, I had him laughing. And I said, look, just for a whole week, just in school, pay attention. And I said, and for that whole week, I want you to do 5 minutes of meditation a day. And I pulled a note out of my pocket, money, and I went, and if you do it for a week, I'll pay you. And he went, cool. So he came back the next week with his dad, and he went, I said, how'd you go? And he went, oh, I didn't meditate every day. I said, I love honesty. There's the money. And so over 3 months, we increased it to 6 minutes and 7 minutes. And at the end of the time, I said, and he got it up to 15 minutes, and I said, well, I said, next, and I didn't see him every week, sometimes it was a couple of weeks. I said, next week you're coming here and we're going to meditate for half an hour. And he looked at me and went, wow, really? I went, yeah, we're going to do half an hour. That kid sat down, he sat there completely still, without a rustle, for a half an hour without moving. And I said to his father, I said, he ain't got ADD. And I said, you can take him away now. And he improved in his studies. He didn't like school, he left school. He's now a very good builder. He found carpentry was absolutely what he loved, and he's become a great builder. But he could do the meditation. You know, there was a bit of monetary prompting. Well, you know, whatever works is fine. So, in the end, again, it comes back to our ability to train our minds. Buddhism is about training our minds. And so developing and knowing that, and knowing the causes and conditions, in a sense, really, what Buddhism is, it's really simple. Finding out what causes a bad result and not doing that. Finding out what causes a good result and doing that. That's Buddhism. And when we look at those qualities of doing a good result, they're all the qualities that society needs. Honesty, sincerity, all the different things that we need come out of a positive causes. So what we do for ourselves, we're doing for the greater good of everyone. And this continuation of these positive actions, they're like a snowball. The more you do it, the more you do it. Yeah?
Right, I'm curious to know, what is the approach to fear? Because I know for many people, and that includes myself when I was younger, fear is a very hard emotion to override, the fear of failure, the fear of what people think of me if I fail,
yeah.
The fear of what other people think of me, the self-doubts.
This is a natural condition for all of us. We're all fear of being exposed. The greatest fear one has in life, apart from being eaten by tigers and things, is public speaking. My greatest fear in life is public speaking. True. Absolutely terrified by it. My first public speaking engagement was I was doing an advertising course at TAFE in another incarnation of my life, and I was asked to give a 5-minute speech to a class of 20. I was about 19 years of age. The moment I was given the assignment, I was terrified, petrified. I can't give a speech. I've got to give a speech in a week. I can't do it. Terrified. So I wrote the speech out, word for word. And I read the speech every day. Literally, I was paralysed with fear of public speaking. And I stood up in front of the class and I read that 5-minute speech in about 32 seconds. And I stood there. The rotten teacher didn't pull me off the lectern. I just stood there. He let me stand there. I stood there. It seemed like about 3 hours. And I'm just standing there sweating. And he said, I think that's all. And I remember walking down, sitting in my seat, absolutely mortified with myself, saying to myself, I will never, ever get up in front of an audience and talk. Ever. That's it. Finished for me. I will never do it. About 5 or 6 years later, I was best man at my brother's wedding. Very big wedding, the full catastrophe of weddings. And my brother said, oh, you're going to be best man. I went, oh, that's cool. What's the best man do? And he said, oh, you have to give a speech. Oh, no. I'm going to die. And I said to my parents, what speech do I have to do? And he said, oh, my father said, oh, you just tell the bridesmaids they look great and, you know. I'm like, Okay, I think I got that. I gave the shortest best man speech in the history of best man speech. I stood up, I said, "Don't the bridesmaids look great? Thank you very much." And I looked out on the sea of this audience, and their mouths were like. And I looked at my parents, and they went. And I thought, "What did I do wrong?" That's what you meant to do. So then, the second time, I said, "No, that seals it. I will never, ever public speak." When I became in many years ago, when my teacher called me into his room, and he said, "You are now going to teach at the Sydney Centre." I went, "Oh no." And he said, "You're going to do it." And I went, "How can you refuse your guru?" I went, "Okay." And the first talk that I gave was to 6 people, and I was terrified. And here I am today. Facing fear is about looking at it directly. And what I wasn't doing in those earlier things were, I wasn't looking at it directly. I didn't find out what was causing the fear, and the cause of the fear was the fear of failure, which was what you mentioned. And gradually over time, I gave myself permission to fail. Tonight I have given myself permission to fail dismally in your eyes, and you know, that's the way it'll be. You can't get it right every time, and you have to, and it's about being compassionate. What I was doing to increase the fear, I was beating myself up. I was doing what you would call negative self-talk. I can't do it. I'm not competent. It's going to be a disaster. I'm going to get it all wrong. And in a sense, that dragged me towards a self-fulfilling prophecy. You also can't do the opposite, which, "Oh, it'll be perfect, I'll be wonderful." That's also. What I should have done was actually do some meditation around it in the beginning and calm myself down and got up there and done the best I could. And this is really the advice that I've actually said to people when they talk to me about public speaking. Do the best you can. Some people will love you, some people will think you're an idiot. That's just the way it goes. But as long as you're doing the best you can, you have to be compassionate to yourself. And this is an important thing in Buddhism. We often talk about being compassionate to others. But if we're going to understand compassion, we have to do it to ourselves. And John Cleese, who had the program Faulty Towers and all the different programs this comedian did, he was a Buddhist, actually. But his first experience of Buddhism was that he went to a weekend on compassion. And he said he was completely surprised. He had to sit down for a whole weekend and meditate on compassion for himself. And what came up was, "I'm not worthy, I should." And he said all this stuff on compassion. Because unless we understand compassion for ourselves, and I'm not talking about ego aggrandizement or whatever, I'm talking about actual genuine compassion for ourselves, we can't give it to others. And so when we are in that state of fear, we're super implanting fear over the sense of being okay with ourselves. It does take practice, but I'm here tonight and I'm actually not scared, okay? I'm actually not scared of speaking. It took a while because that was my biggest fear. But thankfully, my teacher, in his incredible wisdom, could see that that was a block in my life, and that's what he threw me into. And so gradually over time, you start to recognise that maybe you do have something to say from passed on learning that you've done, and that you can impart that. And so when fear comes up, look at it directly. Don't bury it, and don't increase it. One great Lama said, "Don't charge up a thought. Oh, it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be a terrible disaster." This is what I was doing when I first encountered that fear. But it's going to be a disaster. It's going to be terrible. I'm going to be hopeless. You pack all that in, and all you do is just wind yourself up. What I didn't want to be was fearful, and what I was doing was increasing the fear. So this is actually a very advanced technique, the technique of not charging a thought up, letting a thought be where it is. Very advanced technique. It's one of the highest techniques in Buddhism. where a thought comes up and you let it be where it is. You don't add. It's like opening the door of the cold of the steam train and shoving coal in. I don't like that person. Yeah, I really don't like. I don't even like what they're wearing. Look at those shoes. I wouldn't wear those shoes. And look at the way they eat. Isn't it horrible? Oh. That's charging a thought up. Just picking something up and adding energy to it is actually counterproductive for a peaceful mind. And out of a peaceful mind comes contentment. And contentment is really 99% of happiness, actually. Just feeling absolutely okay with what's going on. And when you meet people that are okay with what's going on, they are so nice to be around because they're just chilled. You know, they're just okay with what's going on. And I've got one friend who's an incredible practitioner. He literally has got up at 3 o'clock every morning for 35 years and done about 2 hours of practice, meditation and practice. Unbelievable. And he has had the most disastrous things thrown at him. Just recently, so I won't tell you what it is, but something really terrible happened to him, to his life. And he said to me, it's not about the thing, it's about the way you handle it. And I think, wow, this guy's amazing. And it's come out of his practice. It's come out of his practice of getting to know himself. Many times we don't have the opportunity to change external circumstances. But we all have the opportunity, if we have a mind, to change the way that we look at it. To change the way that we deal with that situation. In one of the texts, the Lam Rim, which is the Path to Enlightenment, which is a particular text of Tibetan Buddhism, when I first picked it up many 30-odd years ago, I got to a page, and quite often when people take up a new religion particularly, or they get involved with Buddhism, they think, oh, I'm a Buddhist now, everything will go right. Nah, doesn't happen that way. Oh, I've become a Buddhist, I've signed up, everything's perfect. Nah, sorry, that's not true. But what I read in this book, it said, due to the wisdom of Buddhism, you will handle things better. You will handle what comes to you in a better way. By just looking at impermanence, when your Rolls Royce rusts out and the tyres fall off your Bentley, you'll go, okay, that's impermanence. That's what happens. And gradually over time, the more you do that, the less you get ruffled by the turbulence of this world. And by doing that, you then, in the interaction with others is beneficial. How are we going for time? Any questions? More questions? Yep?
When you met the Dalai Lama, what did you call me?
Your Holiness.
He's got a name like Dalai.
Mate. No, Your Holiness. Yeah. Any other question? That was a good question. No, that's cool. Any questions? Open to any questions on anything. Yep, please.
How is it that some people can achieve the out-of-body experience through in-depth meditation? How is that possible?
How do they achieve out-of-body experiences?
There has been many recounts.
Yeah, I have never experienced, so I can't say.
But
I will explain this a little bit in Buddhism.
Yes.
There are different levels of the mind. There's gross mind and subtle mind, and very subtle mind and primordial mind, in a sense. It's said in the teachings that the subtle mind, which is kind of like the energetic body, when that is drawn to a place by thought or by mind, that subtle body actually goes to that place. If one's meditation is fine enough where they can, how shall I say, perceive that subtle body, then they can view that distant place. Do you understand? But it requires very, very powerful meditation, a lot of practice. But it's actually said that quite often that subtle body will go where the mind is directed. And all of us have probably experienced thought of a friend we haven't thought of, and all of a sudden they ring. It's out of the blue. Oh, I haven't heard of you. I just thought about you yesterday, or I thought about you. This is considered that the subtle body is interacting with that person or that other place. But it requires, and this is just off the top of my head, requires the level of what they call samadhi, which is single point of concentration where there is no object and subject. And to achieve that, the mind then does not be interrupted at all. In other words, what they talk about, this very deep, deep level of meditation, is where you can hold your mind on the subject without any wavering whatsoever for as long as you like. And there was a story of my teacher who knew a lama who was caught in the Cultural Revolution in Tibet, and he didn't escape, he stayed in a cave. And he said this lama had very high meditation practice. And when the communist Chinese grabbed him, they said to him, "You've been eating food off the villagers and, you know, you're no good." And he said, no, I haven't. He said, "I just live in this cave and I eat simple, you know, vegetables and things." No, we think you're lying. We're going to throw you in this jail for 1 month without food or water. If you survive, we will let you go. He went, okay. And my teacher said, "My friend came out looking better when he went in than when he came out, better when he came out than when he went in." He said, due to the power of his meditation, he did not need food or water at that level for 1 month. And this is the and he also said that the power of that samadhi, of that single point of concentration, you could remember your past lives like you had breakfast, many lifetimes. But he said it requires this single point of concentration. And there was another lama who was discussing this in a book called Blazing Splendor by a famous lama called Thukul Ogyen. And traditionally, these great practitioners very, very rarely talk about their experiences. They don't discuss them. But he asked this old lama what his realizations were. And this old lama in this book said, "I am not like the great practitioners." He said, "So don't think that, but I will tell you of my experience." He said, "I can only remember my past 500 lives, and I can only perceive my next 500, but I'm not like the great masters." So... Yes, okay, so time to meditate. Okay, so the interesting thing about that sounds extraordinarily sort of kind of mystical and impossible, but it's no different to the practice that we did tonight. The difference being is that they did that practice constantly and with the most amount of effort they could do. That's the difference, but it's still the same practice. And that was the thing about the Buddha. He said, "Look, I've got this stuff. Here it is. Take it. Now use it. And use it for your lives." So there's no point becoming a holy meditator and then going out and screaming at someone in the street because they're mucking up your meditation because they're making too much noise. That is not working. "Can't you see I'm trying to be peaceful?" That doesn't work. So your practice of spirituality has to be the way that you act with everybody. How do you connect with everybody? Are you grumpy all every morning? Who's grumpy in the mornings? No one's owning up. You? Yeah, a little bit. Okay. Change it. But looking at look, having a sense of humour about ourselves too, we can get really caught up in the drama of our lives. I'm telling you now, in 100 years, no one will care. It will not matter how dramatic your life is at the moment. So get over it. Alright? Just chill. But we need a technique. We can't just go, "Okay, now I'm going to be enlightened, that's fine." We need to train the mind. That's important. And that's really the lesson of Buddhism. So training the mind is informal meditation. It's listening to the information that the Buddha gave on how to train the mind, looking at the technologies in the information, then integrating it into yourself and see how it works. See how you've always been this way with someone, change it. If you don't have good concentration of listening, start practicing it. And particularly all of you who are going into business at some point or research or whatever, develop this practice of being present in the present. It is not only the Buddhists that talk about this, Eckhart Tolle, many great practitioners talk about this whole thing of just being clear right now. And your meditation provides you with that benefit, and then you can interface with it, and the interface of being present enhances your meditation, and then you develop clarity of thinking. And you can be not only useful to yourself, because in an agitated mind, you will not make clear decisions. You will not study well. You'll not choose well. So we need to calm the mind down. When I was with my teacher in Melbourne, we used to do quite advanced tantric practices. And at the end of it, we were, you know, incredible kind of Tibetan Buddhist technology and stuff. And he'd say, if your mind has calmed down a little, then good result. That was it. After 3 weeks of 7 hours a day of meditation, if your mind has calmed down a little, then that is a good result. And that's really true. If you can calm your mind down a little, you actually start to have a better life. Externally, things may be tough, but internally, you're actually experiencing it differently. And I really think that's kind of the thing that drew me towards Buddhism. Not dogma, but actually how I'm going to work with it right now. Not in the future, but right now. And if you're okay with yourself, then you're okay with yourself. There's an old blues musician said, it's all easy when you're easy. That's it. Okay? Any more questions? Yes?
What's, can you elaborate on, physical pain? Because, I feel like I'm just, so happy, always, except for, if I need to, eat.
Hold it, except for what? Slow down. Except for what?
Except when I'm in physical pain.
Ah.
If I'm hungry or if I'm sleepy, I just hate everyone.
Okay. Hey, rewind. Hold it. I think you've just dug a hole here. And are you about to jump into it? Do you really want to go down this way? Right, I'm getting this, but hold it. When we first talked, you told me you were just happy the whole time and that nothing worried you. And now, right at the end, you've said, when I'm in physical pain, when I'm hungry, this is the point I'm making. You have to look at your life. And then you say, when you're in those situations, you're grumpy and not nice to be around. Is that correct? Have you ever thought of going into PR business? Because you're doing a spin on me at the moment.
But yeah, I guess I'm just kind of like.
Do you meditate? Okay, I'll be back in about 3 months' time, probably, if I'm invited back. They might invite. Will you invite me back?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. He's saying that now. When I get out the door, I go, I want you, here you go, and I've never done this before. This is the first, I've been teaching here for about 10 years. I'm going to ask you to do 5 minutes of meditation a day for the next 3 months. Will you do it?
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
You will do it?
Yeah.
Come out here. Come on.
Minutes
a day for the next 3 months. Okay, good.
Yeah.
You're all a witness. And you can increase it. Doesn't have to be 5 minutes, but it's the minimum of 5 minutes. And then you can tell me how you deal with pain, hunger, and agitation. Okay. Truly, you'll crack it. Okay. Good on you. Thank you. What a gem. Okay, anyone else want to make any deals? Alright, look, thanks very much. I think we'll call it quits there. We've got about 10 minutes to go, unless there's any other questions. Oh yeah, please.
What are your views, this is a bit off topic.
That's okay.
What are your views on diet in relation to Buddhism? Are you a vegetarian?
No, I'm not a vegetarian, but it's actually, and I was a vegetarian for many years, but it's actually a really bad vegetarian. The problem with my diet when I was a vegetarian is I wasn't getting enough protein, and I actually got quite unwell. So I have a little bit of protein in the form of fish, sometimes a little bit of meat, but I believe that it's actually better to be a vegetarian. I really do. And if I lived a life that was less hectic and I didn't need protein, I would absolutely be a vegetarian. So I think ultimately it's the right way to go. I think it's better for your health. It saves animals. Unfortunately, I'm not really in that situation now. But as I said, I got quite sick from being a bad vegetarian. The thing about vegetarianism, which I think is fantastic, is that it's very harmonious for the life. But the problem being is you've got to concentrate on your protein a lot. You know, you've got to get the right balanced protein. But yeah, absolutely, I agree with it for sure. Yeah. Anyone else? Nope. Yep.
I don't know, what I think is a good start to a beginner in meditation, like how many times a day, or you said like 5 minutes or just a little bit, not sitting for too long and.
No, look, you have to do it yourself. But look, start off. Are you meditating now? These days?
Kind of. It's not like the Buddhist meditation, but I.
Yeah, that's okay. I mean, meditation is meditation. But the point being is, it's good to do it once a day. It's even good to do it twice a day. But most of you, this is what I'm saying about don't push it. If you think meditate, and this happened with the TM movement, Transcendental Meditation Movement of the Hindus. When people got that technique, they were told, they were given a special mantra, and they had to do 20 minutes twice a day. And everyone went, yes, we'll do that. After a few months, the second 20 minutes started to fade, and then people just gave up the whole practice. Oh, I'm not doing it twice a day, what's the point? Very sad. So you have to do it within your capacity. Firstly, start off with an amount of time that you can deal with. 5 minutes is great. However, I will say at about 25 minutes is really pretty much optimal. If you can do more than that, that's fine. But starting off very small and adding a couple of minutes a day or a couple of minutes a week is fine. Doing it regularly is more important than doing it once every 3 weeks and going, oh, I'll do an hour here and catch up. That doesn't work. You've got to do a little bit at a time and a little bit every day. Even if it's just sitting on a park bench and just relaxing. If you have to wait in line for something, or you have to stand or sit in the RTA waiting for something or whatever, just sit and meditate with your eyes open. Instead of sitting there getting frustrated, actually use that time to just chill. It's really quite amazing. And one of my Tai Chi students who I taught to meditate, a woman, she's about 65 or so, she was in Brazil and she was caught in this queue going for a plane for an hour and a half standing. And do you know what she did? She just did standing meditation for an hour and a half. And she said everyone around her was like freaking out, and she just went, no, I'm not buying into this. I'm actually going to just stand here and just watch my breath and calm down. And she said it was absolutely okay for her. And other people were freaking out. So you can use those opportunities rather than doing it. But it's good to meditate in the morning. It's good to meditate when you wake up because the mind's fresh. You haven't filled your mind with a whole lot of details and stuff during the day. It's not good to meditate lying down. You'll go to sleep. It's not good to meditate when you're really agitated because you just fight the agitation. So you just do it roughly the same time in the same place every day. It creates a kind of a resonance. And you don't beat yourself up for a good or a bad meditation. You sit there, you do it. Sometimes you'll be right on it. You'll be calm. Your mind will be holding the object of meditation like your breath. And you'll be absolutely fabulous. And you'll get up and you go, that was great. Next day, you ignore the good and the bad. You just do it, you just do it, just do it. My teacher used to say, just trust in the practice. Don't get emotional about whether it's good or it's bad or it feels great or whatever. Just trust in the practice, and then gradually over time, you will notice, but more importantly, people around you will notice that you're actually quite relaxed. They go, geez, what's your story? You're really relaxed, and you might never even know it. It's very hard to tell what it does for you because you don't have a parallel person not meditating. All right? So it's a bit hard to evaluate, but just trust in the process, you know? Thousands of Buddhists would attest to the fact that meditation is beneficial. Thousands of Hindus would attest. You know, Zen Buddhist stuff works. Everyone that meditates says that it's beneficial. When the Dalai Lama found a Catholic mystic in a cave in Spain, he'd heard about this guy who was in this cave for 25 years. He was a Catholic priest or whatever, a hermit really. And he definitely wanted to meet this guy. This is, you know, rare occurrence. And he went to see him, and through an interpreter, he asked this Spanish mystic what he meditated on. And he said, oh, I just meditate on the love of God. And the Dalai Lama said, ah, we have one mind, meditating on love, no problem. You know? So in a sense, what humans do over time, the ones that have the greatest thinking and the greatest wisdom, we come to the same idea. The mystics of many traditions have the same experiences. And it's because we're looking at the nature of our mind very, very deeply over time. And that's what we Buddhists try to do. Some of us in this life will rise to great heights of practice, some not so much. But just being on the path of change towards goodness is enough, actually. And you can't beat yourself up by not being good enough or whatever. You just do your stuff. And opportunities open up, and that's really the message that I've learned in my life. I've had some incredible opportunities. Am I a great practitioner? Absolutely not. Compared to great practitioners, no way. But I just do what I can do within my capacity and feel okay with it. Am I lazy? Yes. I need to be less lazy. But I get some practice done, and that to me is important, you know? All right, that's all. Thank you very much.
Don't print it.